people overthink, and it's just the worst thing you can do, because you will never ever reach a resolution whereby this is great. It's just, they're about momentum, about getting them out, the seeds into the outside world, and letting it grow by itself. And then it sort of almost grows by itself and you kind of follow it.
Are you in your 20s in a job you really don't like? Are you retired and bored? Are you stuck in a rut and can't see a way out? Fact is, the biggest barrier to getting onto the next curve is you. That's right. It is never too late or too early to be who you want to be. My name is Dee Sterling. I'm a businesswoman and presenter, and we are back with our new show, Second Carvers. We will reframe familiar problems and let you take control. Are you a second carver ready to be ignited? So welcome to the spectacular, fabulous Sahar Hashemi. Sahar, thank you for being with me today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Dee.
Great to see you. So Sahar, you are in some ways the ultimate second carver. And, you know, second carving, as we know, is really about reimagining or reinventing, often when it's not expected, but frequently with incredible results. So second carvers step out of dull jobs. They exit painful, broken relationships that have made them feel broken, and they move on to other things, looking for a life full of purpose and hope and real satisfaction at a fundamental level. So that's obviously easier said than done, right? And we're going to unpack some key ways to get going during our conversation today. But I would like to go back to you in your 20s. You've followed the expected route in some ways. You study law, you go and work in a law firm, you really hate it. And one day you're in New York off seeing your brother, the wonderful, fabulous Bobby, and you're walking down the road and you literally smell the coffee. Take me to that time, but really that feeling that you had then.
Well, I mean, really, it wasn't really a sort of feeling. I mean, it was just almost happened by accident. I mean, I saw these coffee bars. And since I was a child, I've loved coffee and pastries. I used to kind of literally beg my mum to let me make some Nescafe and, you know, kind of pretend as if I was. And I literally used to have these pretend coffee mornings by myself when I was young.
Kind of love it.
Imitating my mum with sort of keys in my hand. I always remember that, actually. And so I used to always love it. And I really have a deep love of pastries that go with coffee. And I could just live entirely on pastries if I could, if I didn't have to eat. And so, you know, I just saw these American style coffee bars and I fell in love with it as a consumer. You know, I never fell in love with it as a business idea. And, you know, obviously, you know, the story that fairly well documented is I come back and I say to my brother how much I miss it as a consumer. And he says, this is a great business idea. And thus we start our journey of sort of building Coffee Republic.
And tell me, you know, it's easy for us to look back as wise people, and because the story of Coffee Republic was a big one, is a big one, remains a big one, you know, the first chain of coffee bars in the UK. And, you know, the two of you literally started at ground zero. You were working the day jobs. Bobby was in New York in finance. You were here, you know, trying to get yourself out of that law firm. And when you look back with time at what was a massive success with its highs and lows that you've talked about, what are the memories? What were the real highs and what were the learnings for you?
Gosh, I mean, you know, it was just the highs were the very much, you know, I was a lawyer. I started my life as a lawyer and I loved it at the beginning, and I started sort of plateauing and I started feeling bored. But feeling bored is actually flattering on me. I don't think it was hardly feeling bored. I think I started like not performing, you know, performing poorly, and seeing that I wasn't really great at what I was doing. So there was a sort of slight disconnect in what I did every day as my career. And so I sort of felt like, and it was the first time I felt that, because obviously I'd studied hard to become a lawyer and it was meant to be that for life.
Of course.
And so very much, I suppose, along the lines of what you were thinking around second curve is when you get the ideas why you do second curves, right? So it's kind of, for me, it often starts with some sort of a malaise, some sort of dissatisfaction. So for me, you know, that started once I qualified and I could see everyone else thriving. And somehow I feel I'm not enjoying this, by definition, because I'm not enjoying it. I'm not that good at it either. So I'm not thriving career-wise. I'm not playing to my strengths. So this is all underlying that sort of feeling. So, you know, I always think it's the pain. It's the sort of adversity breeds creativity, right? Like no one sits there thinking, how can I be more imaginative? It's some pain point that drives you to leave the comfort of the shore, so to speak. So, you know, for me, it was very much that. And, you know, to be entirely honest, I think a couple of conversations I had at my appraisals were like, I don't think I was doing that well. So they probably would have booted me out anyway had I left. So, you know, I mean, so just help these people, you know, have ideas. And so therefore, and I genuinely believe that if you follow your heart in a way, and you follow your instinct, you know, sort of like, let's say like the whole thing about sort of universe conspiring, I'm starting to feel less happy, thinking there's something wrong. There must be something else. I'm thinking of interviewing for in-house jobs. I go to New York, come across this idea, tell my brother, do not come across this idea, come across with this love of skinny cappuccinos, tell my brother. And somehow like the universe conspires. And he says, this is a brilliant business idea. And I kind of follow that. And then the law sort of falls away. My bad career falls away. And then I kind of go into this new thing in a way. So it sort of happens like that, if that makes sense. You know, and I that's why I always believe that you should be quite true to yourself. And if you're starting to feel unhappy somewhere, just ask the question and really ask the question. And then
so true, right?
Right. But eventually it comes. So for me, Coffee Republic was, you know, I never thought, oh, wow, this is a business idea I'm going to stick with. You know, this is amazing. It was like, oh, okay. Oh, I'm quite busy today following this business idea. And then I'm busy the next day and I'm busy the next day. You know, I don't think life ever is like, oh, I've just had an epiphany and my life's going to change.
Totally, because it's a process, isn't it?
Yeah, it's life is really the micro stuff rather than the big macro, wow, I've just found a brilliant business idea and I've just become an entrepreneur. That's just a myth, right?
It's a total myth. And it strikes me, just listening to you, and I entirely concur, this feeling of disconnectedness, which I think a lot of people feel just in their lives, whatever they're doing, right? Be it in their work, in their relationships, in how they operate and how they circulate. And, you know, in a way, there's some people suffer often from a kind of psychological homelessness because they are disconnected from themselves as well as, you know, others. I read this quote in a book the other day, which was, you know, the true genius is himself or herself, you know, and it's a little bit getting back to that. I think as well, to your point, often people think you have to have the genius idea and it's all got to be lined up and you've got to be out the door and it's got to be perfect. It's not like that at all, right? But when did you actually go, right, I'm going to step out of the law? Because it was a gradual situation too,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Again, it's just gradual. You know, I was interviewing for jobs, you know, the first conversation I had with my brother, telling him how much I loved the skinny lattes in New York, was actually after a sort of job, after one of those awful headhunter directs. You were a headhunter, so I'm not going to use a headhunter.
Feel free.
But it was after a sort of some headhunter drinks, basically. And then it was slowly like, okay, I'm actually too busy to apply for a job as a lawyer, as an in-house lawyer. You know, when I didn't go to that interview. And then, oh God, I'm so busy that I haven't got time. So just, you know, life is really those teeny little imperfect, crappy steps you take with no direction. And then suddenly you sort of realize, oh, it happened. And so therefore, in answer to your original question, when were the highs? Was, I suppose, you know, still when we opened the first store, it was
of course massive, right?
No, awful. Oh. I hated it. I still actually, it was the 4th of November. And every 4th of November, if I'm in London, especially around sort of Oxford Street where the first store was, I remember the light and I just remember it was almost like a sort of slight sort of feeling quite low. But I suppose in a funny way, I think fear disguises itself by feeling. I just remember that night before thinking, oh, it was almost like an anti-climax. I don't know what it was. I didn't feel as well energized. And I still remember that light, that 4th of November light.
Gosh.
Every year on that time. Because I was so terrified, really. So just, you know, what is this? What are we doing?
Ugh. Yeah, why are we doing it?
Why are we doing it? Is anyone going to come in? Like, what am I doing? Like, why am I buying milk for a coffee bar? Why am I, do you know what I mean? Buying uniforms for someone, like, you know what I mean? That sort of thing. So, and so it wasn't that at all, really. And I just don't know if you sort of ever get those moments. I remember there was one moment when we had opened And I remember being quite far away from from our first coffee bar. And I mean, it's just such a funny example, but I just remember looking in the bin, one of those like municipal bins, and there was like literally seeing a Coffee Republic cup with our logo in the bin and thinking, wow, like, look at it. It's like in the bin somewhere. Someone's like drank it and just like put it there. So that was really amazing, seeing the brand travel beyond the store. And then people kept telling us, God, I love it. When are you going to open? And you could see the energy. And I used to go there every morning. I see people in the queue going, oh, God, we love this. God, I miss it at the weekends. I wish you'd open in Chiswick or, you know, wherever I live. Like, it would just be so amazing. So it really is, you know, people, I think, I always talk about overnight success. You know, people think of overnight success as these eureka moments. And just realizing nothing in life is a eureka moment. It's just rubbish.
Rubbish, isn't it? It's so untrue. Yeah. And I think everyone who's, you know, been told they have an overnight success, you included, will say it took X number of years to make that overnight success happen.
It's just really messy. And then you might look back on it sometime and think, you know, and it's never, the only way I count it is sort of, you know, the high. Where is the high? The high is not even, you know, as they say, don't concentrate on the fruit of your action, concentrate on the action itself. The joy, the success doesn't come from the result, I don't think. The joy and the success comes from every day. You are so engaged in what you're doing. You're so busy. You're so in the flow.
In the flow, right? You're in your flow, right? And that's where all the real joy comes from. But can I ask you, you know, you and Bobby exited at a certain point. And you know, went back for more at various stages. But when you moved along, you went on another second curve because you spotted an opportunity in the market, which, I mean, it was a new market segment, effectively. Did you feel you were in a bit of a flow at that point to go off in a new direction with skinny candy, so sugar, low sugar sweets or sugar-free sweets? Tell me about the motivation there and how you went about it.
Well, actually, I mean, when I left, I kind of wrote my book, and that was definitely, that came out of
the bestseller, of course.
Thank you. That came out of, gosh, you know, I'm really missing it, and I'm actually really bored. And what do I do now? And I'm not going to, you know, be a lady who lunches. So let me do something. And I remember, you know, someone, Julie Mayer, actually said, you know, write a book, and I was like, you know, I don't know how to write a book. I can't even write a thank you
letter. So how did you go about it?
I bought a great book called How to Write a Nonfiction Bestseller.
Okay, well,
page.
Was it useful?
Oh my God, it was like amazing. And I just remember thinking, how to write a nonfiction bestseller. And unfortunately, it's out of print, that book, but you can find it. I just remember thinking, that's how you write a book. Amazing. And I remember the first page, I sort of wrote about, I think I wrote 30 pages and gave it to my mum. And I was like, this is the book. And she was like, this is a good start. Let's expand on this journey sort of thing. So I kind of really out of boredom wrote the book because I was going to go crazy and there was nothing else for me to do. And I'm literally going to go mad, not doing anything. So that was that. And then from traveling, I came across, you know, I was kind of read the book Sugar Busters and thought sugar is bad for you. And then thinking, so it was before anyone knew that sugar was this sort of like white evil. And then I sort of started, then exactly was the sort of genesis of skinny candy. But I never really had as much love in a way, you know, Coffee Broke was very much my first love, and skinny candy never really got there to that extent of passion as it was for Coffee Republic and still is.
What when you think about skinny candy today, what did you learn about yourself having gone into this new market for you? Okay, it's food and beverage, but it's entirely different. Yeah, what you discover about you?
I think what it's about me is that I'm just best setting things when I'm kind of fulfilling my own personal need, where I'm sort of scratching my own itch. So, you know, Coffee Broke came from me wanting skinny cappuccinos. Skinny candy is because I've got such a sweet tooth. And I do also as well care about kind of sugar and, you know, health and weight and stuff like that. So it's always just seeing, and actually this is the pattern I found in, especially women that start a business, is they start from an unmet personal need.
That's a problem kind of, they've had as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Potentially.
A problem they've had. And often solving a problem you've got means if you've got the problem, most likely other people have got the same problem. So it's a really authentic need, which is the sort of pattern I found in entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial behavior, and the pattern I found in female entrepreneurship, but as well in, you know, the work I do now, which is the sort of speaking I do to corporates around entrepreneurial mindset, is the product you're selling. Do you know what I mean? Like, how well do you know who you're selling it to? Are you just selling the product, or do you understand what the problem of the customer that you're selling to? Are you solving a problem, or are you just trying to push a product to them?
Like, why are you actually doing it, right?
Why are you actually doing it? Why do you think they'll buy it? Is it just you just like, you know, doing more marketing and giving them something, or do you really believe that their life will be better if they buy your product or service? And really putting yourself in the customer's shoes, which is the sort of the entrepreneurial mindset, which is the holy grail every company is looking for at the moment.
100%. And we're going to come on to that in a second. But one of the things I'd just like you to give some of your wisdom to everyone listening on is, you know, lots of people say, oh, I nearly wrote a book, right? Or I nearly wrote a bestseller, or I nearly wrote a film script, or I nearly set up lastminute.com, but they didn't, right? So what would you say to someone? Because it isn't an ABC, but you have to start somewhere. And I always think and say, you have to start where you are today, right? And work from that. But what advice would you give to someone who's really wants to ditch the job, they're unfulfilled, they're miserable, or they're in a situation in their life where they really feel stuck, right? How would you direct them?
I would say stop thinking, right? And just doing it. It just seems such a cliche, but you know, my motto in life is leap and the net will appear. So what I have learned through these journeys of these second curves is that you just got to do something, and it's just really crappy, but you've got to do it, because you know, you can write a great business plan, then you can improve the business plan, then you can turn the business plan into a really wonderful deck that you can send people, then you can get a graphic designer to design their deck, then you can go and show the deck to everyone you know, but it's still not going to move your idea just a tiny centimeter forward, because it's just an idea in your head. But instead of that, if you actually turn it into reality, if you make that first phone call, if you do the little prototype, if you have it on your desk, if you, you know, I remember, you know, giving an example, Skinny Candy was a sort of sugar-free sweets idea. And I remember I was actually on holiday with my mom. And I remember just make the idea happen. We were on holiday, but we somehow found a clear bag. And then we found a clear bag. And then we were like, actually like in some cabana, like in the Mediterranean somewhere. But then I actually found a sticker. And then I stuck this sticker. And then I wrote like Skinny Candy, because I knew the name, on the sticker. And then put some sweets I found inside the sticker. And had this bag of like completely made up bag just sitting there. And as soon as it sits there, it's almost the ideas left your head into the physical.
I love world. That. I love that. Right? It's the first prototype of what you produced subsequently, right?
Of what you produced, you know, and kind of, as you know, you helped me very much along the journey. You know, when I got the idea for Buy Women Build, it was like, actually, Sahar, just get women on the WhatsApp. And it's really embarrassing. You got like a WhatsApp group of two people, but it's a WhatsApp group, right?
It's a start,
it's
right?
Change energy. Because if I think about the WhatsApp group of 100 people, or a community of what we call 700 people, I'll never do it. But when you start with a WhatsApp group of two people and you're almost having to apologize, I'm really sorry, this group's only got like you and me on it, but it's a WhatsApp group. What's the start? And people don't realize the power of that. And I suppose, you know, really the advice I would give is people overthink, and it's just the worst thing you can do, because you will never, ever reach a resolution whereby this is great. You know, ideas are never, they're about momentum, about getting them out, the seeds, into the outside world and letting it grow by itself. And then it sort of almost grows by itself and you kind of follow it. And I remember...
I love that analogy, by the way, because it's really planting the seed and giving it attention, right? And you know, to your point about having the bag of candy on your desk,
yeah,
or writing something down, it could be something really simple. I do think, I mean, there's lots of science around this, as we know, but it makes it more concrete. It's like really going, right, that is going to happen now, and taking you outside the domain of just thinking but not doing and not acting.
Oh my God.
You know?
And the thinking and not doing can get you stuck in such a little flywheel of thinking and getting advice, and then feeling G'd up, and then doing, and then not doing. And that's why it's the sort of power of small. You know, I really believe in small.
Love that.
Yeah.
Power of small.
It's brilliant. Really is. It's just tiny steps that are easy to take. And I mean, there's actually a great picture that I saw on the internet. Was like, you know, power of small is like a ladder. Like, imagine a ladder with like little, like where each of the steps are really close to each other, versus if they're like enormous steps, you can never get to the next step. You're sort of looking. But these little, again, it's all about these micro steps. And people think, you know, doing big things is about big stuff. No, it's actually about small stuff. You know, kind of read something great about, you know, how to write a book, how to write a bestseller, how to write a book, is start writing two crappy pages a day.
Yeah, so just actually write, right?
Become something. You know, Pixar says they call their films ugly babies when they start, you know, Toy Story, when it started, was some really crappy shit film, but they got that first draft and then they improved it. And they were, you know, that's the thing. Whereas you have an, you know, the world is just full of people who had ideas. And it's just up here, it's just the worst place. Just got to get out of here. I'm like, it's imprisoned in there.
Oh, totally. And also, to your point, it's about one step after the other every single day. It's the consistency, it's the coherence, it's the having the vision, but bringing it back to base camp and just getting stuff done. And I remember years ago, you said to me, even when it feels like chaos has its own science and its own magic and its own purpose. So just keep acting and keep doing. And to that point, Sahar, you know, over many years, you know, you've written the books on bestseller lists, of course, and read by millions and translated into lots of languages. You've advised major corporations. You've spoken on a global platform to many, many thousands of people. You have really, before we were really actually talking about it, all these years that you and I've been in the ecosystem, you know, championed the whole thesis of entrepreneurship, how to be more entrepreneurial within large companies. And we know that this is not a nice to have, it's absolutely fundamental with the rate of change, not just technologically, but how we're behaving, all these shifts in life and in society, right? Utterly fundamental. And you've been a massive champion for women your whole life. And I would like to, you know, go back to where we were a while ago when you were thinking about your next, well, not even a venture. It didn't even start off as a venture. I mean, you know, if I may, knowing you and you know, loving you as a wonderful friend, this to me felt even then, when we talked about it a couple of years ago, as your kind of magnum opus, right? It was like everything you had done in some ways, even though perhaps you didn't think about it like that, was bringing you to a point where you were going to go into a laboratory, which we used to talk about.
Absolutely.
Right, and create what is today By Women Built. So can we just touch on kind of the feelings and the ripples and the kind of triggers that you were getting that led you to actually start on this journey?
Gosh, number one, I just love the way you describe things. And it reminds me of the many coffees you and I had when, again, this was just a little seed of the idea in my head. And you helped me kind of like bring it out of just the idea, and which I'm kind of always so grateful for. But this was just, it was something which, again, you know, in my computer, in my old files, the amount of book proposals I had about women entrepreneurship, because after my first book was a success, I was like, oh, I can write more books. And then I kept writing these book proposals around female entrepreneurship. But I remember like about 20 years ago, was thinking, oh my God, like there's something about female entrepreneurship. There's something that I don't know what it is. So I wrote, again, you know, do crappy stuff. I wrote book proposals, which never came to nothing. I probably even sent them to my publisher. Yeah, that's not going to be a great book or whatever. You know, it's not going to work. And so, but always, again, that was always just something just in my head. And I kind of, nothing ever happened about it. And then people kept saying, would you ever start a new business? And you know, you and I had spoken, you know, I would, there was something that was missing again. You know, I was very busy on the speaker circuit, you know, writing then my sort of third book, Startup Forever, sort of a couple of the sort of non-exec directorships, getting involved in things. But there was something else I needed. And I don't know what it was, but sometimes just you don't know what it is, right? You're not meant to know what it is. And that's why, you know, when young people go, I don't know what I'm going to do, it's okay not to know.
Yeah, it's normal, right?
But it's almost like, you remember when we were a kid, that game we played whereby like, was a hide and seek or whatever, where you're hot, cold, you're hotter, 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 colder, colder, colder. Like life is all about that, right? Like you're getting closer. Okay, this feels good. Ooh, this feels good. I'm going to get more. And then, oh, this is, I mean, life, I think, is just like constantly these journeys we take. And for me, the fact that it took so long, literally, like I probably had like that After Anyone Can Do It came out 2002 around female entrepreneurship. And can you imagine, you know, Buy One Built didn't actually transmogrify into something I could do until COVID, really, during kind of that first 2020 lockdown, autumn of 2020, when this idea came to me through this tweet, right? So, and I literally remember sitting at home and I just had a foot operation. So I'm sort of like literally stuck there and there was nothing at that time going on. So I'd have got time on Twitter and I remember where I was in my house and I'm going through it and I see this tweet. And the tweet says, not all of us can invest in women, not all of us can mentor women, but we can all buy from them. And it's right. Just that, like, it was almost like, again, you know, everything that I ever wanted to do conspiring into this really powerful thing. You know what I mean? This was it. And I remember calling Jacqueline de Rocas, who'd actually written the tweet, saying, Jacqueline, this was really powerful what you said. And thank God nowadays we've got everything documented so one can remember, like, my first reaction to it was the email I wrote to her. I was like, this is really powerful. This is something really amazing. And then again, you know, followed that little teeny lead. And the next thing you know, I'm speaking to her. Next thing you know, I had been speaking to someone called Barney McCauley, who was a marketing expert. Him and I were always talking about purpose. I don't know how it got me to write an email to Barney after, like, you know, we'd been out of touch probably for about a year, going, do you remember we talked about purpose? What about a consumer movement? Getting, you know, and there was the whole time around Me Too, around women empowerment, Sarah Everard sort of happened, that
right.
whole tragedy and that whole feeling of the whole country coming in saying about women, we want to support it. How can we do something to support women? You know, everything kind of conspires into this, what you, your word, which I always use, oceanic swell. I love that.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a very de-sterling word, that, the oceanic swell. It is about oceanic swells. I mean, you literally have to trademark that word because the,
I think just, so.
Yeah, because you get these little ideas and then suddenly you pick up little teeny, teeny things and then it just gets bigger and bigger and the momentum is such that you end up doing things. But of course, as you know, I could have easily just, it was an idea and I actually sat on the idea for about 16 months with just an idea.
But it had to percolate, didn't it? It was really, I mean, I do love this analogy that you and I use of the laboratory. You know, you go in and there are adjustments and it's like a kind of, it's got its own biochemistry and you have to try things out and not hold on to them, right? Which is what you did. And that's really important for everyone listening because it's not just like, ta-da, that really never happens. I mean, yeah. Well, virtually never happens. So I think it's just following the instincts and being open and also moving quickly, right? Going, well, that's not going to work and this is going to work. And, you know, also I'm doing something that's good for the world. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be a social enterprise, which is what a lot of people think. You know, it's got to be some sort of charity because they're doing good, which I mean, I completely disagree with, even though, you know, we have our foundation and all the rest of it at Center for Entrepreneurs. I think you can do good and have the best people doing good for many. Right?
Absolutely.
And look after them in the right way. And so for anyone who doesn't know, Sarah, just give us like the top line on Buy Women Built, what it's about, who it's for, basically for everybody, and what the mission is.
Lovely. So exactly. So again, Buy Women Built is a consumer movement to showcase women built brands, to get consumer support behind them. Because what better way to support women than buy from women built brands, right? Because we know that a pound of revenue, proper revenue, is much more worth to a business than you know, we always talk about investment and lack of investment, but what about actually getting consumers? And just saying, why should we promote women businesses, right? So not only is it good for gender parity, not only does it empower women, but in the UK, the Rose Review, again, that I was involved in, and I'm sure you contributed to, it was, you know, our rates of female entrepreneurship are incredibly low. So we've got a problem in the UK.
We really do. Give us the stats. I mean, the stats are just pretty appalling, aren't they, still?
We're 30% behind countries like America, Canada, Netherlands, in our rates of female entrepreneurship. If we were the same as they are in America, the Netherlands, 200 billion would be added to the UK economy. If we have the same rates of female entrepreneurship as we do male entrepreneurship, that's 250 billion. So there is that 250 billion gap that we can fill by having more women entrepreneurs. And guess what? Women make incredible entrepreneurs because a lot of the qualities you need. So basically, so we started this movement to almost kite mark, showcase, identify, look at how many incredible businesses around you are started by women. And you don't know that these businesses are started by women. You're buying them already. You love the brands, but we're missing a trick. The fact that no one ever told you there's a woman behind this, because number one, you can't be what you can't see. So how can we encourage more entrepreneurship? And lack of confidence is a huge issue. So the more you can say, look at this amazing brand that you're buying, Jimmy's Iced Coffee, now that it's cold, we're all buying drinks. Did you realize Susie is behind this? And it was Susie's idea, you know, when she comes back from Australia. So it's almost like connecting the dots around, you know, what women, and it's almost like I've done this because it's almost like my, as you say, I don't know, what did you call it? Opus Magnumus?
Or? Magnum Opus.
A Magnum Opus.
Because it's really
magnum
is.
Magnum Opus. I should write that down.
I'm going to send that to you.
It's actually saying, look how much women have accomplished. Look how extraordinary women are. Because I genuinely believe women are just extraordinary creatures. I've never met a woman that's not strong. It's just that for some reason, there's something stopping us from reaching our full potential. I don't know what it is. It's fear, it's lack of confidence. So by showing what everyone's done, by connecting them, So it's a consumer movement, but behind it, quite as you've seen, what's grown is a community of female-founded brands. Because, we realized very early on, Barney and I, that we're not going to be able to spend like $20 million a year doing a consumer campaign. But what better than to get these brands to become our amplifiers? Because each of them have a huge voice. So we have a community now of 700 brands that have applied.
Incredible.
We started with 100 on the WhatsApp. We're going through these applications, which is why I don't have time to breathe at the moment. But and every brand, every time I think, I think I know every single female-founded consumer brand in this country, another one comes up. But I'm like, how did I miss this? You're amazing. You've got millions in sales. How did my due diligence not catch you? And so therefore, people got to raise their hand and say, hello, I'm Women Built. And I'm going to say I'm Women Built because that's going to help this $250 billion gap. It's going to help gender parity. It's going to inspire future generations to find
absolutely work. To that latter point, the fact is, and you've talked about this, young people, young women, teenagers, they don't, if you ask them to name three female entrepreneurs, they can't even name one. And also, to your point, if you can't see it, you can't be it. Whereas if you've got someone that you look up to, and we see this in certain sectors, such as the investment world, there are so few women, right, in the corporate space. That is not going to inspire future amazing women to go and join the troops or the ranks, right? And I think, there's a kind of contribution to the PLC of this country and probably others by buying Women Built. But also, I love this whole, it's not even a concept because you're doing with the whole idea of movement, right? Like when you create a movement, it's not about just buying another this or that. It's about really thinking about it, knowing that you're contributing to something bigger, knowing that to your point, you can play a role, even if you're not going to set up a business, but you can also do that. And I hope lots of people will sign up for Kite Marks after this. We'll have all the details in the show notes. But you can support and you can actively play a role, right? It's a bit like voting, right? I always think, if you don't vote, you don't have a right to complain about the government or anything else that's going on. So exercise your right to, and your obligation in some ways to engage, right?
Yeah,
and play a role.
100%. And they're amazing products because, again, goes back to your initial question, is that, what I found, the thread in entrepreneurship, and especially female entrepreneurs, is we just did a survey about community, and 97 of them started because of a personal need they had, something they were lacking. Be it one of them had eczema, her child had eczema, Child's Farm, Genesis of Child's Farm that just sold for $38 million, to Julian Poonan, who has 17 allergies, that started Creative Nature Foods. Every single one of them starts from a personal need. And so therefore, it's a business that was not there to take market share. It genuinely solves a customer problem. So they're hugely innovative. That's number one. Number two is, in this world is, when we hear so much, and kind of that new book has come out by Jean Twenge again around this generation and the loneliness that they feel and the issues that younger people have, that disconnection that is resulting in this kind of mental health crisis. It's actually, I believe when you choose to buy a product from a woman, when you're a young girl and you're getting all this other messaging on social media around, how big your thigh gap is. And then next thing you know, you're actually choosing to buy a product and you're like, oh, I've read the story of this woman. This is a woman that, lives in the UK. She just, she comes from this background, whatever, I might relate to, and I'm buying her product. There's a connection there in this hugely disconnected world that you wear, I'm a woman of a certain age, and yet all my products around me are Women Built. And I feel more empowered when I choose Women Built. I feel this sort of solidarity and it makes me stronger when I buy. So that's why I feel consumers feel stronger when you choose to buy Women Built than just buying from some,
Also, it strikes me that part of this, and we've talked about this a lot, it's like really leading with your heart, which is really leading with the essence of who you are, right? And what you do in life and how you engage with life, with yourself, for starters, and with others. And you know, with what you buy and where you buy. And we are much more sensitized today because of the environmental crisis and, you know, the impurities in the food chain and food insecurity and all these different things, right? And we're much more sensitized to plastic in absolutely everything. And we've discussed this also with the wonderful Shan Sutherland in this series. But I think it is about how you engage with things, how you get out of your head, and how you literally, you know, can be part of something bigger by your participation. One of the things I'd like to talk to you about briefly here, because we've touched on, is this whole confidence thing, right? Because if you want to change your life, you need to take a leap of faith, don't you? You don't really know what it's going to look like. Or if you want to change your job, you have to take a leap because it's not going to come to you. As my aunt used to say, you know, nothing happens if you sit at home on the sofa all day, right? There's nothing coming to you. No new job, no amazing, you know, business that you're going to set up, no new husband or whatever else you're looking for, right? So it is about action. But what do you think we can do as a society, and what are we doing, particularly with women and women setting up businesses? Because we know the confidence component is an issue, continues to be an issue. What can we do to shift that?
Well, Jude, I mean, I think it's just kind of, in a way, you know, where does confidence come from? You see, I believe people are not born confident. I mean, maybe some people are, you know, particularly confident, but I'm not sure if you're born confident necessarily. That's where it might be misplaced confidence. It might be someone's rather sort of arrogant, you know, what someone's born confident. I think confidence comes from self-practice, right? So, like, you know, where do you get your confidence from? It's not something you can just suddenly read a book and become confident. I think confidence is, again, is you tried something, you take a bit of a punt and it worked. So you're like, oh, I might try that again. That was interesting. Or, you know, even if it didn't work, you're like, well, you know, the world didn't come to an end. Like, you know, it was okay. Like, I learned something. I feel a bit stronger, so I'm going to try again. And so it's sort of confidence really comes from, you know, it's like a sort of baby learning to walk, right? Like, you know, the difference with a baby learning to walk versus adults trying things. It's a baby falls, everyone's like clapping.
Grandma, so true.
They're like cheering the baby on.
Yeah, you can do this.
Well, you can do this. And the baby... And I wish we could do that to ourselves as adults, right? So, because confidence, I think, is just practice, right?
It's, you know, like, what? You're so right, because it's actually about just doing it and giving it a go, right? I always say that to anybody that will listen to me, like, just give it a go. You're not going to die. You know, it'll only be a no, or it won't work. And then you'll try something else. You'll still get up tomorrow morning and have a shower and brush your teeth and get on with your day. So just, that is the message, isn't it? Just give things a go.
Yeah, it's a hinterland of like thinking to yourself and dreaming and stuff. It's just like, just get over that. Like, it's just such a waste of time, really.
Such a waste of time.
What I mean, right? And just, and you know, all, you know, scrolling through and comparing yourself to, on social media, to some person who's sort of putting on this kind of facade on social media. Such a waste. Just get so busy doing that you've got no time to look at anyone else or even to doubt yourself. You know, my point is, you've got to be so busy doing stuff. You don't really have time to kind of do a navel gaze.
And you've always said that. And by the way, I love the term that you've just coined, like self-practice. It's a bit like, I always say, you know, you're going to have a fantastic day today if you start it the night before, you know. And you and I talk about the morning and the morning of the moment of hope. And you get up and you seize the day and you have your little rites and rituals, whatever they are for you, to get you going on your mega highway, right? Your power lane, which is your power lane, and it's not someone else's.
It's only your power lane, exactly.
Right. And the fact is, too, to your point about even scrolling, you know, in no other context would we, unless we're on an, you know, on a flight and looking at a magazine or something like that, you know, you are going to control what you digest, right? You're going to choose to read a book or choose to watch a film or whatever. Whereas people scroll mindlessly. They don't even select the things they want to scroll through because it pops up on their feed. There's this lack of discernment. How do people use their time? You know, there are ways to tighten all that up again as ways of practice, self-practice, right?
Yeah. And just doing something. And then it's almost like your credibility to yourself builds up, because that's the most important thing, right? Like your self-credibility. You've done it. You got out of bed, you made that call, then you're like, actually, that was quite easy. You know, I'll do that again. It's sort of, I can do that again. That's fine. And, you know, I think, honestly, it's sort of the one thing I have learned. And I think if I was to say one, the gift I have is this ability to actually not think. I just didn't think really. I just learned to switch my brain off and just make that call and not judge it afterwards. And we all fall into the trap. You know, I've had moments where I'm like, and with you or with people I'm close to, just thinking, oh, shoot, that might be a mistake. You know, like on kind of be entirely kind of candid, just about 3 weeks ago, I had the moment where we'd launched a community tool on Buy When Built. And it was quite a big step for us. And I was really like worried about the community tool. And I was speaking to my brother and he was like, God, you sound really stressed. And I'm like, oh, I just thought we made a mistake. You know, this could be a mistake. I just want it to really work. And I was being quite sort of intense. And my brother was, you know, bless him, he was like, actually, can we just go back to what you tell everyone? You know what I mean? Leap in and that will appear. Actually, it's just, what the hell? Just don't overthink it. You just tried it. Worst comes to worst, it was the worst thing you ever did. But just don't think about it. And I remember just suddenly I was like, actually, just freedom. This is just, it's in beta mode. It's not final. This doesn't have to be a success. I'm just trying this. I've just changed it from we've done this big step to trial and error. Let's see if this works.
And it's part of that process, right? I also think that, you know, in a way, not overthinking most of the time is one of your superpowers. And I think that when we are more ourselves and we're tapping into that, you know, those moments of flow, and we're really being ourselves, that's when we're charged. That's when we get stuff done. That's where the moments of brilliance come. That's where we can really do things that actually matter, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Exactly. And that comes with practice from just doing it and just releasing the thinking and the judgment. Because, you know, I mean, the only person with a gun on our backs, honestly, is ourselves, really, and our judgment and our fears. And, you know, kind of fear has got a funny way of dominating us, I think. And, you know, it dominates us through comparison. It dominates us through, which sort of feels almost easier, right? So it's just being really careful of that and just switching off that brain and just doing stuff. Because you always know, there's always something for you to do. There's always something that you can do. And then it's only when you look back, you're like, oh, that was amazing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think too, you know, fear is part of the process, feeling a little bit fearful. That is absolutely to be anticipated. So we have to get over ourselves. And the fact is, bluntly, people are so busy doing their own thing that they don't really mind if you're messing up over here or if you're in your own personal laboratory trying to work it out and get on to the next phase, right? Because they are consumed elsewhere. So Zahar, it's been incredible to talk to you today. One final question from me, which I'd love you to share your views on it. What are you personally, given that all you've achieved, all that you've done, and all that you're doing with Buy Women Built, which is at a really exciting phase of its own development and growth, what are you most excited about as you look out towards the future?
You know, it's really bizarre. It's almost like it just shows my sort of lack of long-term thinking. It just, every day is amazing. And I'm right now excited about, like, you know, the going through the 700 submissions. And then once I do that, I'm sort of, I always try not to think too far ahead because I think that can stop me, do I mean, of doing what I need to do. Because sometimes, you know, thinking too far ahead, we're almost limited by our human thinking. And, you know, things can be so much bigger. So I don't know if you want me to share what you and I, the sort of secret code.
Yes.
But you've taught me that. And, you know, what we have to all the listeners that Dee's taught me is we have this thing we remind ourselves, shoulders back, channels open. So shoulders back, channels open. Shoulders back means don't stop, you know, because by definition, if you're not overthinking and you're just like relaxing into it, your shoulders are back. And channels are open. It's just like literally just being open to what's out there. So shoulders back, channel open, which is you and I, our code work every time, because all of us as human beings go off track. We get into these little rabbit holes. Shoulders back, channels open is what you've taught me, Dee. And I think that's what we should just do. And vice versa.
Get
amazed by what comes along, really.
Absolutely. Zahar, it's been such a joy to speak to you today and to see you. Thank you so much.
I loved it. Thank you.
Hi everyone, Dee here. I hope you enjoyed this incredible episode with my amazing guest. I hope you're enjoying the series. We'd love to hear from you, so do DM me and tell me all your stories of second curving. Lots of love.